Welcome to the Principal Podcast today. This is Xane Anderson. Today, I am absolutely thrilled to have Adam B. Coleman with us today. He is the founder of Wrong Speak Publishing. He's the author of The Children We Left Behind, which is an amazing, incredible book. Adam, thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So Adam, let's talk a little bit about your journey. Let's talk a little bit about what made you want to write The Children We Left Behind?
I would say the two primary reasons. The first one is a lot of the different articles I've written for publications like the New York Post, I would always see a family angle to the social issue that we're talking about, or in a particular event like a mass shooting. Actually, there's a couple of articles I wrote about mass shootings and the impact of their family situation. And that became like a common theme. And especially like if we talk about homelessness in places like San Francisco, well, that homelessness is linked to drug addiction for many of them. They've been taking drugs, not just for a couple of years, but they've been taking some sort of substance since their teenage years. That's not an uncommon thing. And why is that the case, that a teenager would need to take any sort of constant substance, not experimenting, but something to subside from something or to distract themselves from something? And often it's because they're growing up in dysfunctional environments, growing up around physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect. Maybe they're even children who were a part of the foster care system, and the next logical step for them, since no one cared about them in the first place, was to end up on the streets. And they've been there since. And that's a story for a lot of young people. So I use one of the stories, a big story that happened in New York City with a homeless man who was who had later died after being restrained or held in a chokehold after he was screaming and threatening people on a subway. And it got turned into a racial incident. But for me, I wanted to use the story because his story is not an uncommon story of someone who was in the foster care system, before the foster care system, had to deal with an abusive home. His mother was murdered by his stepfather. You know, all these particular things happened. And then a decade or so goes by and he ends up dying in a subway car. So for me, my question isn't, why did this particular thing happen? It's like, well, what were the litany of steps that led for him to end up in that circumstance where he could be put in that position to die? So I just think that it's a big thing that it's happening all around us. And I say the second thing is, even though my childhood wasn't to the extreme of drug addiction and things of that nature, or incarceration, I dealt with something that's more common. I dealt with a sense of rejection growing up without my father. I dealt with mental health issues, suicidal ideation, depression. I dealt with all these particular things, and these things are very, very common because a lot of kids are growing up outside of a two-parent household, where they're asking themselves, why they're different? Why are they different than everybody else? Questioning if they deserve love. All these different things happen to them. So those are like the two primary reasons why I actually want to write about it.
Right, and I should have mentioned the subtitle here. It says, "How Western is the Children We Left Behind, How Western Culture Rationalizes Family Separation and Ignores the Pain of Child Neglect." And you have been through this journey of not having a father present when you were growing up. You've been in this journey of even experiencing some periods of homelessness. You can relate to what's happening. When you see these people, like you described, like Jordan Neely, who were had the situation they had, in some ways you can say, hey, the root of the problem here is really the deterioration of the family unit. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. And it's not to say that if every kid was in the same house as their parents, that there'd be no crime or any of these other social issues, but I think you would see a dramatic reduction in. I think this goes beyond the United States. This goes into United Kingdom, for example, where there is, in some areas, criminality issues, maybe not so much homelessness because they have a really big social safety net, so to speak. They have a really big social system, which has pros and cons. But you're seeing it in different ways. You're seeing where it's just children of divorce. You're seeing where the adults are thinking about themselves. You see the same type of dynamics in all of these different nations, and they're primarily throughout the West. And these are prosperous nations, relatively speaking. These are nations that where people have plenty of options, and also nations where we're very advanced when it comes to communications. And some of that is communication of ideas. And some of them are good ideas, some of them are bad ideas. So I do think that we're dealing with messaging. And it's not recent. I think we've been dealing with this for maybe a couple of generations, two, three generations, where the messaging is that men and women are fundamentally different, which is true. But because they're fundamentally different, they're optional to each other. And so the women receive that messaging first. And obviously, not every woman, but some women absorb this message for various reasons. And I have a chapter called The Daughters We Disappoint, where I talk a little bit more about the type of woman who would absorb that type of message and see men as optional. But now we're dealing with the men who have grown with a level of disdain, whether it's right or wrong, the reasoning for it, whether it's factual or maybe it's just life experience for them. But they're growing a level of disdain, and they don't believe that marriage is something that's possible. Too great of a risk. Everything becomes about the women, the woman, and the woman. In the same way that feminism is all about men, it's a reaction to men, right? The reason I want to be a career woman is because I can't trust men. It becomes all of these different things. These ideologies grab a hold all these different people. And the reason why it grabs certain people, not others, is because for a lot of these people, they grew up in an environment where the opposite sex couldn't be trusted. So for these young women, they grew up in an environment where their father wasn't there, or maybe their father was there, but he was abusive, right? So whatever their father is, he becomes the model of what a man is in the future for many women. So if they can't trust their father, why would they trust some strange man that he's going to be better than her own father? Or if her father didn't show up at all, how could she trust that any other man would do any better? And these are mental hurdles. And then you have an ideology and a culture that comes in and says, actually, it's not just your father, it's all men. All men are suspect. And we're seeing the same type of seeds being planted when it comes to young men, right? They're looking at their mothers, and some of their mothers are dysfunctional. They're looking at their mothers, and their mothers chose to divorce instead of staying with their father. They're looking at their mothers, and they can't trust their mothers. And so they grow up and get taken advantage of by these ideologies, by certain influencers, by these different people who profit off of their confusion and off of their frustration from what they experience. And they're saying, actually, it's not just your mom. It's not just your first girlfriend who broke your heart. It's every woman. Every woman's hypergamous. Every woman is all for herself. Every woman is this. So don't be vulnerable. Don't get married because they're going to leave you anyways. Just live an avoidant lifestyle. Treat women as objects. Have sex with them and throw them away. And they're leading down this path that is, in my opinion, ungodly, and it leads you to a path of nowhere.
Yes, and we're buying into this narrative that marriage is not needed, or other people are optional. And in the chapter, "You're Not the Mother and the Father," goes one part that stood out to me. It said, instead of emphasizing the importance of fathers being in constant contact with their children, the mantra reaffirms to the children that men are optional when raising a child. And this lack of trust, as you said, One of the things that's so important is that kids can trust, and they're frankly entitled to have a mother and a father in the home who love them and who care about them. Yes, we have different roles. Children learn completely different things from their mom and their dad. Some the same, but some very different. And we as children, one of the things that really made me, frankly, want to have you on this podcast is you're saying, let's stop being selfish and keep our commitments to ourselves when we get married, and make our, let's not be selfish. Let's realize that we have these precious children in our care who we get to care for and raise and inspire and lead and save them from a bunch of pain, which you've experienced from not having a father in your own home, and are now trying to be the change you want to see in the world by helping other fathers by writing this book, which is very noble.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
and the other thing is, I'm throughout the book, I'm not trying to be too judgmental because I also understand that for a lot of young men who are like myself, who grew up without a father, they also repeat the same type of behavior that they experienced. So if their father didn't come around, and then all of a sudden they're making babies with all a bunch of women, and they're not coming around their kids, right? Even though they know deep down that that act hurt them as kids, but they want to forget that and they live their own life and they don't see the importance in themselves either. But for a lot of men, later on in life, they mature and realize the ills of their pain, or the ills of their ways and how much pain they cause. And they feel regret. And so one of the areas where I realized was that this book, and even just talking about these things, not only opened up an avenue to helping the children who were left behind, a child like myself, but for the fathers, or even the mothers, but specifically the fathers that I've dealt with who have made mistakes and regret, like made obvious mistakes. We all make mistakes. Parents, we screw things up. But they made, critical mistakes by not being there, by not doing the right thing, by choosing themselves over their child, and they regret it. And or divorce happens, and they've the relationship with their child has been fractured. And so I've been very fortunate to come across two or three men, maybe more. I've lost track, but I've come across men who are like, you know what? That's me, and I regret it, and I feel like it's too late. And so this is why I talk about, even though my father had left me behind and my father's no longer alive, if he were alive, if he attempted to, I would give him a chance to build a new type of relationship with me where I could learn from him. Yes, he wasn't there in my upbringing, but it's a way to heal, and I've already forgiven him. So writing the book is not about having animosity. It's more about showing the disappointment I had when I was a kid. But I've forgiven my father, and I've forgiven my mother in certain areas as well. So it's not about wagging my finger and saying, I know the right way. Everybody else is bad. Every parent cannot be redeemed or anything like that, which would be very unchristian-like of me to say that. It is to say that forgiving someone is extremely hard thing to do, but it's an incredibly necessary thing to do. But for the fathers, especially, whether they were pushed away or whether they walked away or whatever reason, but if they feel a sense of regret, once they have that feeling, it is their duty to fight, to apologize and take ownership, and fight to have some sort of relationship with the child, because it's up to you as the parent to establish a relationship with the child and not vice versa.
That's super important. So to any dads out there who are saying, well, you know, I made these bad decisions and I'm just going to continue along the path I'm going, you're saying, no, be brave enough to step up and ask for forgiveness. Ask, try to repent. Go back and ask your kids, say, I'd like to be a part of your life. Maybe you were pushed out because someone was alienating, but do your very, very best to have that relationship with your child because your child needs you. They need your fatherly influence. Brave, right? That's what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, absolutely. And as far as like a strategy for any father who's going through this. Don't make it about the mother. Don't make it about, well, you need to learn my perspective, because at that point, it does not matter. Your perspective doesn't matter at that point to your child, who is already frustrated with you because you made these mistakes, because you chose yourself over them. It needs to be about accountability. I messed up. And let's say the mother did certain things, but you know what? They're angry at you. And I'm sure that there's something that you contributed to the situation. So acknowledge your part. I messed up. And I realized that me messing up has hurt you. And I am sorry for that. That's it. And make it about them. What can I do to show you? You know, I'll do anything. I'll do anything to show you that I am serious and I want to be in your life. And they may say, F you, and close the door on you. But what you don't do is say, well, I tried, and you walk away. Because what, and I understand it. When someone rejects you, you're like, well, listen, I tried, and you just walk away from it. But for your child, it's different. See, you hurt them, and they want you to feel what they felt. So you rejected them. Now they're rejecting you. But what you show them is that that initial rejection is not stopping you, and that you are serious. And they may put you through the ringer for a month, for a year, for 5 years, 10 years, you don't know. However long, until they feel that is that you have shown that you're serious about being in their life. Because as soon as you step away, you say, see, they weren't serious at all. Rejecting me once again, leaving me once again, just like they did when I was a kid. I knew it. I knew he was trash. Right? It becomes you validate it by giving up. So if you're going to be in their life, if you want that, you have to be willing to take every unfair blow that they send towards your way.
And that is a mark of being a Christian. You know, one of the things I liked about what you said here. Some people could argue and say, well, it's her fault, or it's mostly her fault, or it's mostly my fault. Well, let's just say it's 99% someone else's fault, but you still had 1% that was your fault, right? What you can do is take responsibility for that 1% completely without making it say, well, I did it because they made me or because of the situation. Just say, you know, what I did here was my fault. Or maybe it's 20% or 100%, whatever it is, acknowledging what you did wrong is a mark of maturity. And usually in any relationship, whether it's a marriage relationship, parent-child relationship, both people make mistakes. So it's mature to be able to come and say, hey, this is what I brought to the interaction, even if it's just 1%, even if it's 10% or 50 or 100 or 90, whatever it is, acknowledge what you did. Have the maturity to say, hey, this is where I blew it, and I want to tell you that I'm sorry, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I also think I like what you said about that consistency, that being consistent. I remember my father telling me, and actually my mom and father, I come from a well, my mom died when I was eight, but they had a good marriage. Come from a family where I was came from a two-parent family, but I remember my mom saying something like this. She said, she had pulled back at one point just a little bit, but my dad was consistently there when they were courting. I think she had pulled back just a little bit. My dad was consistently there. And that was one of the things that made her want to be with him, is because even though she had pulled back, he was consistent. And I think as we want to put our, here's where it gets a little dicey. Some people say, well, I'm going to put my children first, and because I want to put my children first, I'm going to divorce my spouse. And I would say that that thinking is backwards. In fact, putting your marriage, putting that relationship and saying, I'm going to invest in my spouse and make them I'm going to have God first, but then I'm going to have my marriage and then my children. Now you might say, well, why would you put your children before underneath your marriage? Well, here's the truth. If we put God first, our marriages fall into place. And when our marriages fall into place and they're good, that super helps the children, right? And so staying together and saying, you know what, even if we're having a bad day, even if we're having a bad month, even if we're not sure how we're going to work this out, we're going to do everything we can in our power to try to be good spouses to each other, to have a good marriage, because that good marriage is going to help our children.
Yeah, that's exactly it. The marriage staying together, not, gritting your teeth, but in a healthy way, is for the benefit of your child.
Absolutely.
Splitting apart because you two have too big of egos to say that you're wrong or that you're sorry or whatever it is, or you're just tired of sleeping with the same person and you want to chase something that's out there or whatever that might be. Or just plain old giving up on something because you're just bored. These are things that you want. These are things that only benefit you. It does not benefit your child. And so that's why I talk about the rationalization, because no person thinks that they're a bad person. And no one really thinks that the choice that they're making is the bad choice. Every person who makes a choice thinks that I'm doing this because it's a good choice. It's the best of, even if it's two bad choices, it's the best of the bad choices, right? So everyone thinks that. Sometimes people rationalize to get to the choice that they ultimately want. And so you have to do that in order to come to that point where you could say, I just want to sleep with other people. Well, why is that? Well, it'd be selfish for me to say that. Well, let's just say I'm not happy in my marriage because our sex life isn't there. And I deserve to be happy, right? I mean, my child doesn't want to see me miserable, and if I'm happy, my child will be happy. Like you just have the litany of rationalization points all the way through to the end where you rationalize that as long as you're happy, your child would somehow be happy by osmosis. And that is something that only benefits you. And at most, you might hear, well, divorce is detrimental, but you know what? I'll put them in therapy and they'll be fine, right? Which is not true because I could tell you how many
Not
people
true at
still have
all.
that childhood. Yeah, they still have that childhood wound. They manage it, but they still have that wound, right? You still got the Band-Aid on, but the wound underneath is still visible. So like these choices, or even the choice to just procreate with whoever, having children with multiple men, or as a father, having children with multiple women, right? We have a lot of very wealthy men who like to say that I'm a great dad. And because they're wealthy, everyone presumes that they must, well, they can afford to do this. That's the answer. And this is part of the cultural thing where men are only viewed as economic beings for a family. And that's it. So as long as he can pay for his kids, then he's a good father. Doesn't matter that he has a kid in California, a kid in Florida, a kid in New York. Doesn't matter. As long as he can support the mothers who are there and throw 500,000 here and 200,000 here, and he's just taking care of kids all over the world, then he's fine. He's all good. He's a good father.
There is so
And
much more to providing for your children
right.
economically. We would need children need spiritual guidance. They need emotional guidance. They need a father to be present. It's so much more than just sending money. And you're right. We need to change that narrative, Adam, that men are only worth it if they can provide for their family. You can be the most poor father, and if you show up and teach your kids principles and spiritual things, you can be a great job. And you could be a very wealthy father and completely blow it because you're not teaching your children and giving them the guidance and the nourishment that they need from that they can only get from dads. And that's one of the reasons that I'm so glad you're here on this podcast, because we need a movement of men who realize it's more than just providing money, and it's more and kids need you there in the home. And it is not women got it. You've said that in your book in multiple ways. Like, we need a mom. There's even a chapter you said you are not a mother and a father, is one of your chapters or close to that. We need men who show up to lead spiritually, emotionally, mentally, teach their kids principles, teach them to be confident, teach them to be kind, teach them and have that manly influence in the house. It is not just about the money. In fact, you said something here in one of your chapters here. You're not the mother and the father. You said a 5-year-old doesn't understand the value of a dollar. They know the value of your time when they are adults. When they are adults, they won't remember the nondescript toy you bought them to play with, but they will recall how you weren't there to bond with them. The time to being there is super, super important.
That's exactly it. The time, the lessons, the effort. I can think of like my son. My son's 19 now, and I can remember the first time he had like a little girlfriend, a girl that he liked, and she became his girlfriend, and she broke up with him. And being there for him, to talk to him about it, and have him understand that what you experience is not abnormal. And it's okay. And matter of fact, let me tell you about mine. To have someone to relate to, because I remember when I was a kid, when I would make mistakes or I experienced some sort of heartbreak or something like that, some sort of disappointment, I thought it was just me. I thought, like, oh, this didn't work out because I'm a screw up. And I put that all on myself, not realizing, like, oh, like just about every guy goes through this. But I had no one to talk to about it. I didn't know that it wasn't just me who's feeling this way. I didn't have someone that says, "It sucks, I get it, but you know what? Next time you'll do even better.
And it
Let
would
me
be
help you
helpful
out."
maybe to have a dad who says, you know what, in life you're going to get your heart broken sometimes, and you're going to be okay, and you're going to break some hearts, and that's okay, but that's just part of life, and have a confident father explain that to you. So when it did happen, you're like, oh, my dad said it was going to happen, and it's okay, and it's not the end of the world, right?
Exactly. My son had this long distance relationship, and we had this when he first told me about it, I was like, let me just tell you, it's not likely to work out. But you know what? Enjoy yourself and see where it goes. And so when that relationship ultimately came to an end, he wasn't like heartbroken. Like he wasn't, mopey or anything. He was living his life. And I said, what happened? Oh, I started working more hours, and then we were working different shifts, and they're in different coasts and stuff like that. So, we just ended it because it just didn't make any sense. And I was like, good. And if I was in his shoes, which I was at one point, having a long distance relationship where she broke up with me, I was like, I spent like 2 months depressed. Like I was just out of it. Because I didn't have anybody to talk to about it. I didn't have anyone to relate to what I was going through, to express that heartache. I didn't have anybody to just be honest with me beforehand, right? That male honesty, like, listen, I know you like this girl, but I'm just letting you know, here's what's probably going to happen. To kind of have me aware, like, okay, at least I know the risk of what I'm about to get into. That's how guys like to think and risk and reward. But if everyone, and this is not to like say all women are like this, but it's a feminine tendency to want to say, to lean on the fantasy, to everything's going to be magical. Oh, it's going to be wonderful. And no one's real with you. Like,
And a dad a lot of times has the unique ability to say, hey, I'm going to give you some hard truths. These are the hard truths, right?
right.
And kids need to hear that. In fact, they found that kids who come from authoritative homes where the dad, not I'm not saying cruel homes, I'm saying like authoritative where there's rules and a dad steps up and lead, do way better because the kids learn those hard truths. We'll talk about it. Finish your thought there.
Yeah, just ultimately what I'm just saying is I see the difference between how I grew up without my father and how my son grew up having me involved in his life. And my son at the age of 19 is more mature, more confident, able to deal with disappointment better than I was able to deal with disappointment, is not self-loathing, is not depressed all the time. I mean, we were both hardworking, but he's hardworking. Like my son, that's why I tell people he's the better version of me. And I am incredibly proud of who he is. He's a tall, good-looking young man who's highly respectable and very respectful to people, who works really hard and has a vision as to what he wants to do with himself. And another big thing, he's not chasing women. He's not looking for external validation. He's happy with himself. He's willing to delay gratification. Quick story, I'll say he started working at a restaurant. He wanted to be a server, but the only way he could get a job, he had to start busing. So you know what? He started busing tables and cleaning up anything and everything they told him to do. And in a time span where I think he said it usually takes like 6 months, maybe closer to a year to possibly get the opportunity to become a server, he worked so hard that he was able to accomplish this in a few months.
Good for you.
And he was that, and that's the type of hard work that he was able to do. And I can tell that in 10 years, when he gets into the career that he wants to get into, those lessons of humbling himself and saying, you know what, I'm going to prove myself and I'm going to work really hard, and they're going to want to give me that position that I wanted, because they're like, if he's willing to do that for busing tables, he's going to be a kick-ass server. And that's what he was able to accomplish.
I love that. And by the way, I just want to tell you, Adam, my hat's off to you for being the change you want to see in the world. For you stepping up and becoming the father that you didn't have. And that's my hat's off to you. One of the
Thank you.
things you said earlier that I wanted to just touch on, and we t one of the things for those who have listened to the Principle podcast here before, they know that one of the things we talk about is how principles control our consequences. Let's touch on it briefly here. So, there's a principle, a scientific principle called gravity. Gravity works where I'm at, it works where you're at, it works on the other side of the world, works in North America, South America, North Pole, South Pole, Asia, Europe, everywhere. Africa, Australia. It even works out in space. It keeps the satellites going around the Earth. It keeps the moon going around the Earth. It keeps the Earth is held in orbit around the sun by gravity. It's everywhere. When we come in contact with a principle, we have two choices. We can either align with it or we can ignore it to our peril. So with gravity, you could align with it. And let's just say we're trying to make money by aligning with it. We could align with it by building a ski resort. A ski resort, people come to Vail, Colorado, for example, to ski down the hill. Well, gravity pulls them down that hill, and the people who build ski resorts have aligned with gravity, and they make a lot of money doing it. You could build a hydroelectric dam. You could build a skydiving company or a roller coaster amusement park. But if you ignore gravity, so if I align with gravity, I can do these kind of cool things. If I ignore gravity, I could fall off a cliff and die. And here's the point. Gravity is the same. Whether gravity is helping me make electricity for millions of people because I built a hydroelectric dam where the gravity is pulling the water through, or whether I'm about to fall off an 800-foot cliff because I've kind of been careless, gravity is the same. It could make me wealthier or it could kill me. And here's the point that I want to make with parenting. One of the things we need to teach our kids is you can do anything you want in life, but you do not control the consequence. What controls the consequence? Well, principles do. So the principle of let's talk about principles. If you want people to trust you, if I'm talking to my child, you've got to be willing to tell the truth even if it's hard. If you tell the truth even when it's hard, people know that what you say is real. If you decide to lie, people are going to know they can't trust you. That's as big as gravity. You can align with it and build a hydroelectric dam, or you can fall off a cliff. Honesty controls our consequence. I want people to trust me. I've got to keep my word. In other words, if I am married to your mom and I stand there and make a commitment that I'm going to stay with her, I make a commitment before God to my wife that I'm going to marry and stay with her. And then things get tough. Let's talk about feelings in a second. Or I'm feeling like I need to go do something else. Well, the truth is, if I want people to trust me, I've got to keep my word, even when I don't feel like keeping my word. Well, that's a hard truth that a dad can teach their kid. We keep our word even when we don't feel like it. And when we do, people trust us. Our wife will trust us. Our kids will trust us. And that, if I ignore that, then people don't trust me. And you can't have trust and break your word. You can't have trust and be dishonest. You can't say I'm going to be with you till for the rest of my life or forever, and then break that commitment and have people trust me. So if I want my children to trust me, if I want you, anyone, I've got to keep my word to myself. And if I, you know, if I break it, I need to be different. So teaching our kids principles and to follow principles over feelings. And this is the last thing because I want to get your opinion on this. There is so much emphasis right now, even with counselors and other things, where it's like, well, how do you feel? How do you feel? How do you feel? And the truth is sometimes our feelings take us in bad directions. Think about what you said before. Our feelings, like I feel like going and running off and chasing another woman, or I feel like being angry, or I feel like not taking care of my obligations. Well, if you just follow your feelings, I hate to say it, you're gonna get fickle results. Maybe instead of making it all about feelings, maybe make your decisions on principle instead. So there's principles that are just as real as gravity, honesty, the golden rule, treating people like we want to be treated, the law of the harvest. Like if we don't plant and work hard, we're not gonna have a crop at the end. You cannot cheat principles. They're bigger than you. They're bigger than me, just like gravity. And we need our kids to make decisions on, hey, what's the principle behind this? I'm going to be honest and keep my word, even though I don't feel like it. I'm going to stay married, even though right now I'm frankly not feeling great about your mom, because I promised and I'm going to keep my word. I'm going to be honest. I'm going to work hard. These are the things that govern our consequences. And when kids know that consequences are determined by principles, and as your dad, I want you to have a successful life. And so I'm going to teach these principles to you. It's not just about a paycheck. It's not just about, did your mom get enough money to support? It's my job as a dad to teach you principles so that you can have a good life and you can be confident and have a good life. Tell me your thoughts on that.
I think you're onto something there. I will say that honesty has been a probably like the number one thing when it comes to the relationship I have with my son and the relationship I have with my wife. With my son, it's a little bit different now when they become adult. My son's an adult now, he's 19. But throughout all the years growing up, I told him our relationship is about honesty. And so do not lie to me, and I won't lie to you. Like that's been the basis. So the only time I've ever been mad at my son was when he lied to me and he didn't have to. Because I said, if you mess up, just tell me so we can fix it together, right? And we just move past it. But do not lie to me. And so by having that honest relationship where 99%, he's been able to be, I would say, kids, especially like my son, he wants to impress his father. He
Yeah.
doesn't want to like, he wants to tell me the truth. He doesn't want to tell me all the truth. I'm fine. Man, I can tell you're not. Like, just tell me what's going on. Like, sometimes you got to pull that out of kids. You have to pull that out of them to show that it's okay that you're not doing okay. Like you have to do these things to develop trust with them. But for the most part, my son has been honest with me and I've been honest with him. And so now as an adult, he can call me and say, "Hey dad, here's what I'm going through. What do you think?" And he knows that I will not sugarcoat anything for him. Like he knows I'm gonna be honest with him. I'm like, well, this is probably a better idea than doing this because of this and this and this. He's very analytical, and that's how I am too. So, and we're pragmatic about certain things too. So he knows I'm not going to lie to him. Like I'm going to tell him, just like, his long distance relationship. I'm going to be like, listen, man, I know you're happy about it, but I'm just going to let you know. Enjoy yourself right now, but here's what's probably going to happen. Right? So not to, crap all over your parade. But I just want to let you know, because I want to be honest with you. I don't want you moving in a particular direction thinking that everything is rosy. And then no one told you that this is actually a bigger risk than not. And the same thing when it comes to my wife. I don't sugarcoat anything with her. Right. So, and if she says this too, so I can repeat this. She's told me, she's like, I like it when you call me out on my shit. Like, and it's because, well, one, I love you. And if I love you, I'm gonna be honest with you. And you're my friend. So I'm not going to co-sign some BS that you're saying. I'm going to call you out on it, right? Just like I want you to call me out on it if I'm saying some BS. And then we talk about it, and I won't take any offense to it, just like you shouldn't take any offense to it. Like this is an element of love that I don't think that certain people practice. I think we have an element of love that is everything is always fine and everything is wonderful and no one ever makes any sort of mistakes or bad decisions. And it's like glaringly obvious that this is a bad decision.
Yeah. And sometimes to be loving, you don't pretend. Like, for example, if my child's playing in the street and there's trucks coming down the street or cars in the, it's not loving to say, oh, it's okay. It's loving to say, you get back in here, get out of the street, and you teach them really hard. Like, I don't want you to have the consequence of getting ran over by a truck. And so I'm going
Right.
to teach you and call you out that running in the street's not okay. Sometimes you have to be direct and say, hey, this isn't good. And that, by the way, is loving, isn't it? To tell your kids there's boundaries, there's rules, and the rules are not there to hinder you. They're actually to help you.
Right. And this is also a cultural element that which is why the book is a cultural book. We are dealing with an out of balance society, right? So we're dealing with a over feminized reaction to life and an under masculinized, I guess that's always the way, yeah, under masculinized sensibility. So we are supposed to only think about our feelings. We are supposed to sugarcoat everything. You know, the chapter in the book talking about socially comfortable, terrible parents. The underlying thing
Yes.
is everyone is cowardice. Everyone wants to be comfortable, right? No one wants to rock the boat. Women tend to be more agreeable and care about social ramifications more so than men. However, culturally, we're telling both sexes to act more in that favor, to really care about the social dynamics of every room they walk into, to not rock the boat. You know what? That's their business, right? To not be honest because you're worried about how is that going to affect us. You know, I don't want to mess up our relationship. Meanwhile, a child is being abused, a child is being neglected, you know, and you're allowing this terrible parent to be socially comfortable. So you hide their secrets. Right? You turn a blind eye. You turn away from how they mistreat their kids. They talk to their kids like they're trash, and you say nothing about it because you don't want, you know, that's not my business, and I don't want to get. So everything becomes about your comfort, and it's not about that kid. It's not about someone who cannot defend themselves. Children don't have full rights like adults. They can't get in their car and drive away from an abusive home. They can't go and earn money so they can live on their own away from their terrible parents. They can't do any of that stuff. And we have certain laws that are basically bare minimum, right? So as long as they don't pass that bare minimum of, you know, physical abuse, which is questionable in certain circumstances, sexual abuse, things of that nature, you're allowed to be a terrible parent, right? There's a huge gap in between when CPS can come and take your kids and being a good parent. There's a huge gap in between. And I think socially we have to discern, listen, I may not be able to call CPS on it, but you know what? You're being a shit parent right now. And I love you and I love your kid more. So we need to talk about this because what you did was unacceptable.
And I thank you for sharing that, Adam. Let me tell you my view on this too. And my view on this is that you're exactly right that we shouldn't make people doing horrible things kind of validated in what they're saying. That's what you're saying. Like, here we have people doing bad things. And at the same token, there's a lot of people who think, well, we just need more government. We need more social something or social, more of this, or we need this politician or that politician, or we need this po more social programs or less social programs. But the truth comes right back to the very thing you wrote this book about, is most of the ills that we see in society had their root in the home, that was neglected or overheated. And by the same token, the solutions to these same problems lie in the home. In other words, there are some things government's not going to be able to fix. Let me give you one example. I'd love to hear this, but I know of somebody who did it. I'm not going to go into detail because I don't want to shame this guy, but I'm going to tell you this. There was one guy who was did some horrible stuff. It was very viral. It went public. This particular guy is going to be in prison for probably 20, more than 20 years. It's going to cost the taxpayers for all the medical, for all the court and security and incarceration and everything. It's probably going to be north of $1 million, maybe even up to $2 million or so dollars to try to fix this problem. Well, the problem was is that he was being violent. And they've done some studies that have shown. Now, by the way, one of the things I really like that you said, like at the end of your book, you said your childhood doesn't need to define you or your potential, and you're living proof of that. And I love that. That being said, so you are literally like an anomaly who's made it. Even without a dad, you're still doing good things in the world. Some people say, well, look at it. Even in your book, you address this, like, well, look at Adam, he's fine. And you're saying, no, I really wasn't fine. I had a lot of stuff I had to overcome because of my lack of dad. They found that the vast majority of guys who are going to prison don't have dads in the home. This one particular person I'm thinking about, which I'm not going to get into too much detail, I found out he did not have a dad in the home. So here's the thing. His cost to society, the government, the taxpayers, might run $1 million or $2 million, let's say. What did he really need? Well, he needed a dad when he was 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and 10 and 12. The first time he got a little pushy with his sister, or he was being a little unkind, to say, hey, you know what, son? Let's talk about the principle of the golden rule, which is just as real as gravity. Let's talk about how we treat people. How do we handle it when we're feeling angry? And have that guiding influence with him so that he wouldn't be having this lack of a father for 20 or 30 years, and now the taxpayers are going to try to fix him, and the statistics say it's probably not going to happen. So the problem was he didn't have a dad, but the solution is he needed a good dad. Can we really, as a society, afford $1 million or $2 million every time somebody decides to do something violent and have to go to prison? If we don't have enough parents that are good, and you know this, Adam, there will never be enough policemen, there will never be enough prisons. We need good dads. And that's one of the reasons why I know you're on this movement to help dads. I'm on this movement to help dads. We need a worldwide movement to help dads step up and say, you know what, even if I blew it in the past, I'm going to repent. I'm going to apologize. I'm going to ask for forgiveness. I'm going to come back and try to be the dad I need to be. Leave the past, come back and ask for forgiveness. Try to be in your kid's life. Do what you need to do because your children need you. And I'm going off.
Amen.
But the
No.
problems are not going to be solved by government. They're going to be solved by dads and moms who decide to keep their commitments to each other, who decide to even when they're not feeling happy, they're going to say, I made a commitment and I know my marriage is important and it's so important it's going to affect my children and my children's 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 children. Let's keep our commitments. Let's be honest. Let's teach the golden rule and those kind of things.
Yeah, and what you're talking about is essentially, and this is one of those areas why fathers are incredibly important for young men, is throughout their life, they're teaching their kids emotional regulation. And what you find is the kids who aren't taught that are the ones who are overly emotional, are the ones who become violent in an instance. They're the ones who lose their temperature real quick. Like they go from 0 to 100
Yep.
because they were never taught to manage their emotions. They were never taught that, listen, losing your temper is really detrimental to society, right? Men are the
Yeah.
stronger sex. And so if you're 5, right, you can do a little bit of damage. But if you don't address it at 5 or even before, when they become 15, they can steal a car and ram it into people. They can grab a knife. They can find a gun, right? And they can take their frustration out, right? They can be easily slighted. They can run to their emotion instead of regulating their emotions and having them think about every step that they make moving forward. So, emotional regulation was a big thing that I was doing with my son, which is why my son is incredibly calm. He's incredibly measured. He thinks before he reacts. So he goes through all these particular emotions and or not emotions, these thought processes before he becomes emotional.
There you
Right?
go.
This is an
And he has a
incredibly
dad, you, who taught him to do that. You taught him to go through the thought processes, and because he wants to, he wants your approval and he wants your acceptance and he wants to be good, and he's listened to you, and you've made a difference in his life that you didn't have. And that's what you're saying.
And on top of that, not everything is through telling. Like you can tell a kid to be calm. All right. But there's something about mimicking behavior that humans do, right? So when they're around other people, people have seen that like in friendship circles, right? And I've done that just unintentionally. If they speak in a particular way and you're around the same group of people, you start speaking like how they speak, right? So it's something that you adapt to. Humans adapt to their environments, right? They mimic behavior. And when a father is around their sons mimic the behavior of their fathers. Why? It's a lot easier to mimic my father than my mother, right? He's the most important parental figure to me. So it's not just by saying, right? A lot of parents are like, do as I say, not as I do. And it's like, well, that's not how things work.
Right.
Like the kids are watching you. And my son has my mannerisms in many ways because he's been watching me. And whether he consciously knows that or subconsciously knows that, like he's picking up different things. And it's kind of scary when I catch him doing things that I do.
Right. Sometimes we would, as dads, we could say. Yeah, there's three things that are important in teaching kids: example, example, and example. Is what I've heard someone say. But yeah, keep going.
Exactly. So that's a really, really big part. And I do think that especially for young men who have felt rejected, who have felt that they don't have an outlet to express themselves, added on top of they don't know how to regulate their emotions. See, for me, I was always inward when it came to my frustration. Other kids are outward. So they're the ones who punch holes in the walls. They're the ones who cause some sort of damage. They're the ones who hit people. I was the opposite, right? So for the ones who are outward, they're incredibly dangerous to society. And when it comes to, let's say, we'll use criminality because you mentioned men who are in prison, vast majority coming from households where their fathers weren't there. And then you see their antisocial behavior. And it's because they didn't have anybody to teach them how to be emotionally appropriate in social environments. So they're just all over the place and they're antisocial because of it. For men in this particular situation, it doesn't take a lot of them to damage society. So I'll use an example. I might be messing up numbers, but you'll get the point I'm talking about. I was talking to someone about in Minnesota, they had a rash of carjackings and stuff like that, and breaking into cars and stealing. Like it was a big problem in the city of Minnesota. And like in a major city like that, it's a lot of people, and people were feeling like their car might get stolen, like they might get carjacked left and right. And come to find out, I think it was like 12 or 13 boys, essentially, because I think they were usually like around 16, 17, maybe 18. But it was 12 or 13 of them that were doing it. That was it. It was 12 or 13 young men who were carjacking people. And so even in a city of, I don't know the population of Minneapolis, because it was the city of Minneapolis, but let's say it's like 1 million, 2 million people. Even in a city like that, it only took 12 or 13 people to make the entire population feel like that they're not safe and that their cars might get broken into. So it doesn't take a lot of people to really ruin just one single city. If, for example, if you lived in a neighborhood that had 500,000 people in the population, but there were 100 people who walk around with AK-47s, Would you feel safe? You're like, oh, well, it's only 100 people who walk around who are incredibly violent, have AK-47s, and shoot at people. You'd still feel very unsafe in that particular environment. So it doesn't take a lot of people.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And my guess is, if we go to the root of the problem, not knowing the full story on this, but so I need to be careful here. My guess is that those 12 or 13 boys, many if not most of them, probably came from dysfunctional homes where they didn't learn the principle of the golden rule, which is we treat people like we want to be treated. Nobody wants to have their stuff carjacked or stolen, and we're not going to, They probably, most of them, my guess is, didn't have a strong father figure to say, "Hey, son, this is why we're going to keep the law of the land. This is why we're going to do these kind of things because it's good for our society and it's good for our spirit and it's good for our families. It's good for to follow." And when they have that guidance from a strong father figure who they respect, most in the statistically, the chances of those kind of things happening go way, way, way down. Now, you can still have a present father physically who's maybe emotionally and totally checked out as well. I mean, there's guys who they're physically in the home, but then they go out and they have workaholism and they're working and working, trying to make dollars, and they're not really checked in. And you still can have some of those same problems. We don't just need a man sitting in a home. What we need is a man acting like a dad to lead, not just with dollars. Spiritually, mentally, emotionally, to provide to and to protect from outside influences that are harmful.
And something important to highlight, when especially when it comes to those young men who are antisocial, willing to commit violence, willing to steal your stuff, willing to do all these very antisocial types of activities. What people have to understand is some of them may not be just coming from a home that's dysfunctional. Some of them may be coming from sexual abuse, right? So it's not even just that their father isn't there. It's that they're being abused. Maybe they're being physically abused. There's a detective I got to know in New York City, and he would talk about how they would arrest a perp, and maybe they have to go to the hospital for something, and they're doing paperwork. They're not in the cell. They're just kind of with them and just sitting, waiting around. And these guys would just talk and talk and talk. And he would just sit there and listen and let them talk. And he said, you wouldn't believe how many of these young black men have been molested when they were children. And it's a constant thing that is happening in these environments. And it's also why within the book I talk about the dynamic of allowing a man into the home who is not the biological parent. And for these women to understand that these men can be predators. They're choosing you, the single mother, because they know that you're tired. They know that you're stressed out. You're trying to take care of your kid, but you're trying to work. You're trying to be in two places at once. And here you come, or here this guy comes as the white knight, who's ready to make your life easier. Says, I got you. I'll look after the kid. Don't worry about this. And they take care of you in the bed and all of these different things. But all they wanted to do was get close to the kid. They're predators. They'll sleep with the mother so they can gain access to the children. They'll gain your trust. So when you see something that seems kind of weird, you'll just shrug it off because, well, no, that's, Bob isn't like that. And they'll gain access to the kids. And if we're talking about racial demographics, where the majority of black children are growing up in homes where it's led by a single parent, we are talking about a disproportionate amount of children growing up in highly vulnerable environments. Add on to the factor where single parenthood is a leading factor towards poverty in lower economic situations. And allowing for someone else to come in there and say, I'll pick up the slack. Don't you worry. I'll give you the emotional, sexual needs that you want and financial needs, and we'll move in together. And just being unaware of how much danger you're putting your kids in because of that That is opening up a world of hurt for these kids. So to me, when he tells me that, it doesn't shock me that the kid who never learned how to manage his emotions, who's displaying antisocial behavior, was molested as a child. And on top of that, no one heard him. So no one heard him, no one cares. And you cannot be shocked that the person who is antisocial, who doesn't give a damn about your car, and doesn't give a damn about your personal safety, feels that way because no one gave a damn about how he felt. No one gave a damn about what he was going through. No one tried to stop the predator from accessing him.
And so we've got these, you're correct. Like the bad things that happen are then sent down for generations, right? So the choice of parents to say, hey, I'm going to split up and I'm going to go off and be with other people, and because that's what I need to feel fulfilled. Again, we're talking about feelings. Like, I need it to feel fulfilled, which is completely against principles, right? Which is completely against, it's like ignoring gravity, right? Instead of keeping my commitment, my marital bonds, and trying to work through it and trying to make a happy marriage, even though we're struggling, even though we're having a hard time, I'm going to still fight for that marriage and stay together with my parent, with my child's biological father, biological mother. We're going to work it out. A lot of people are saying, well, I feel like I need to leave and go and find myself or go do, and they use their feelings as justification. And my point from the previous point was, like, what if we made our decisions based on principle? Like, we made a commitment. We need to teach the golden rule. We make our decisions on principles, not on our feelings at the moment, because our feelings can go back and forth. Let me give you one example. Stephen Covey was talking about, and to your point here, because a family broke apart, you're right, they expose themselves to all these dangers later on, and their kids to these dangers later on. So as you said, the mom who's now considering allowing somebody to come else in because they've decided to divorce, didn't realize that when they divorced or broke up or whatever, that there would be all these other downstream dangers and side effects from that choice. Let me tell you this. So Stephen Covey, who I is a, I think he wrote The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. He was talking about how he was at a conference. Somebody came up to him after the conference and said something like this: "I don't love my wife anymore." And the guy, and Stephen Covey looked at this guy and said, "Well, then love her." And the guy said, "Well, I don't love her. I've fallen out of love with her. We don't feel any love for each other." Again, feelings, right? And Stephen Covey looked at the guy and said, "If you're not feeling it, that would be a good reason to love her." And the guy goes, "Well, how do you love someone you don't love?" And Stephen Covey looked at the guy and said, "You know what, my friend, you're talking like love is a feeling. Love is actually an action. It's not a feeling, it's an action. But here's the kicker: if you do the action, the feeling will follow." Did you hear that? You can actually lead your feelings by doing actions. If, in other words, if I'm not feeling love for my wife at a moment, let's say we're having a hard day or hard week or something, and I'm not feeling it for her, the answer might not be, "Hey, I got to go get a divorce so I can find myself, so I can go find some other woman." The answer might be for me to go give her a foot rub or to do the dishes. And it takes a little while, but you can lead your feelings with your actions. And for kids to learn that, for us dads to teach our kids, you know what? There's going to be times when you don't feel like doing the right thing. And it's in those times where I'm going to tell you a hard truth. It's important that you do the right thing anyway, and you'll eventually get your feelings back to feeling like doing the right thing. But we've got to be strong in those hard moments. And that's something that's important for our kids to learn. Important for our kids to know it's not all about how do I feel at the moment, because how do I feel at the moment? I might feel like going off with some other woman. I might feel like doing something wrong or being violent. I might feel like doing these things, but what I need to do is still make the right choice, even though I'm having these feelings that are not in alignment with principle. Being violent is not in alignment with the golden rule. You know, running off with some other woman is not alignment with being honest and keeping my commitments of trust. And when our kids can see that example of my dad, you know, he might struggle with feelings as well, but he's learned to emotionally regulate. He's learned to keep his commitments even when he doesn't feel like it. He's learned to do, you know, they can then model that own behavior. They have that own behavior in their own life. Does that make sense?
That makes absolute sense. Yeah.
Yeah. But back to your point about being protective, like you're right. We talk a lot about feelings, and feelings are important, but I think our kids need to know that we need to make our decisions based on principles, not our feelings at the moment. And there's so much emphasis in our culture that, like, well, I don't love my spouse anymore, so I must have married the wrong person. I don't feel it for him anymore, so I'm going to go try to find someone else where I can feel it with him for a while. And in fact, I read something from somebody named Abigail Shrier. She's talking about, she said a lot of the problems we're seeing, there's a book called Bad Therapy where there's been so much emphasis on feelings, feelings, feelings. And sometimes, truthfully, we need to learn to make decisions against our feelings. I mean, that's
Yeah.
just truth, right? I mean, sometimes we have to repress our feelings, gasp, right? Like we have to do something that's against what we feel at the moment because it's the right thing.
Or at the very least, ask yourself, where is this feeling coming from? At least examine it.
Right.
Because maybe the reason you want to chase another woman is because you're not feeling loved. So maybe instead of chasing another woman, you need to speak to your spouse about how you feel, right? So there's some sort of action to it. I'm against the I'm feeling a particular way, so I'm just going to I'm not going to communicate it in an appropriate way. It's like when you're angry at your spouse, but you want to pretend that you're not angry, but it's all over you. They can tell, the energy in the room is different. You're not reacting the same way. Like, you're better off just putting some sort of action behind that emotion, right? A healthy action. So the healthy action is to communicate how you feel. So the feelings, I mean, we're human beings, we feel a particular way, but I think a healthy action to it alongside the principle is really important. So the action could be you go sleep with some other woman. That'd be an unhealthy action against the principle. That you stated, or you stay within your principle, but you set some sort of action behind it rather than building resentment because you didn't do anything about it. So whenever I talk to, sometimes I've talked to my wife and like, she feels a particular way about someone, and we can go on and on and on it. And I said, well, did you talk to them about it? Well, no, I didn't talk to them about it. So then, what do you expect to happen? They can't read your mind. So you need to talk to them. And so many times I've showed her that, and I've done this myself, so I'm not trying to say I'm perfect, but like there were times where she had this notion about whoever it was that she has not communicated with. She just went off of how she felt and whatever was going on. But when she put some action behind it, there's like two or three times I could tell you, but the person, especially like in a work environment, the person that she didn't get along with because she just didn't talk to the person and she presumed that they hated her and all this other stuff, ended up being their best friend or ended up being someone they really like and now they hang out, all because they put action behind those feelings in a healthy way to communicate. So I think communicating how you feel is incredibly important. My wife and I, we became friends first. And we built our relationship off of talking to each other. So we're very comfortable talking to each other, being honest with each other and patient. My goal isn't to win arguments, it's to express how I feel and hear how she feels. And maybe I apologize because of whatever, and she'll apologize because of whatever. And then we just move on because our goal isn't to win or to make her look bad or make myself look good. Our goal is to sustain our healthy relationship. But yeah, we have our feelings, and so we need to communicate these feelings. So
Yeah.
there is no resentment building. So there isn't like this elephant in the room. I hate elephants in the room. I just let's whatever is going on, let's just acknowledge it as soon as possible so we can work past it, so we can go back to being good.
I think you're exactly right. I think that communication piece is really, really important. But tempered with this, let me give you one more thing that I'd love your opinion on, Adam. You know, they I had the opportunity years ago to communicate with a really renowned marriage therapist. And this marriage therapist, I asked him a question. I said, "What if there was one thing that you would tell people who are married that you think would help marriages more than anything else?" So we're talking about that today. Like, how do we have marriages that stick together and thus benefit children and their children and their children for generations because we keep our commitments? But he said this. He said, "You know what? The thing that I think would help people more than anything else is to realize that we're not responsible for each other's feelings." Think about this for just a second. He goes, "We are 100% responsible for how we think, which causes our feelings, which then lead to actions." So the problem that we see in a lot of marriages is where somebody doesn't believe that they're responsible for their own feelings. Let me tell you what I mean. If I come to you and I say, "You know, Adam, I'm mad at you because you did this," or you come to me and say, "You know what, X, I'm mad at you because you this." If I go to my spouse and said, "You're making me mad." Now, here's the truth. What they did really might have been not productive or hurtful. But the truth is, the feeling is caused by how we think about that feeling, okay? How we think about what happened. So let And if, he goes, "If people would realize this, you'd have way, way, way less problems in marriage where people, because let me give you one example. Stephen Covey walks into this train in New York City. And as he walks in, he sees this dad with a bunch of kids. But no, excuse me. I'm telling this story wrong. He's sitting on the train and the dad walks in. He's sitting on the train. It's a peaceful Sunday morning. Everybody's just kind of minding their own business. This dad walks in. And there's his kids start being really disruptive. They're running around. They're being kind of bugging people and just being really loud and obnoxious in some ways. And after a while, he becomes a little irritated. He's irritated at this dad. And he finally goes up to the dad and says, "You know, could you kind of control your kids a little bit more?" And the dad looks at him and says, "You know, I'm sorry, their mom just passed away. We just haven't known what to do." And all of a sudden, his feelings of irritation towards this man went from, "I'm not irritated anymore. Now I'm feeling compassion." And it was really because of the thoughts. His thoughts were, "This guy should control his anger." But his thoughts weren't based on reality. He didn't realize that the guy had just lost his wife and the kids were just running around. And so his thinking about that situation wasn't based on reality. It was just, "This guy's a bad dad. He should control his kid. He's not. He's just neglectful." The truth was, guys just lost, and so he became compassionate. The story you're telling yourself about your spouse is so much more important than what's actually happening. It's the story in your head. So you could say, "You know what, my spouse is being hurtful," but you're right, you showed compassion. Like you talk about homeless people who are now not here but we didn't really understand their whole story. So if we can go into a relationship saying, "You know, I am responsible for how I think, and those thoughts cause my feelings, and those feelings cause my actions," instead of saying, "It's your fault that I feel this way. You're making me feel this way. If you would just change, then I would be okay." That very thought that somebody else is the problem is the problem. And so we've got to go into a marriage thinking, "I'm responsible for my thoughts, I'm responsible for my feelings, which cause my actions. And so I'm really, really going to be careful about the thoughts I'm thinking because I know they cause my feelings. Those feelings cause that." And to realize that. And then, as you said, to communicate and say, "Hey, when this happens, I know this is the way I'm choosing to feel," but it's taking responsibility, not blaming you for my thoughts and my feelings. And that's an important part of having a marriage that works, is when both people realize, "I'm not going to blame you for how I'm feeling. I'll communicate, but I'm not going to blame you." Does that make sense? I'd love to
No,
get your thoughts on it.
that makes absolute sense. My wife and I have displayed that in our marriage, and that's why I tend to, if I have a problem with my wife,
That's a
it
hard truth, by the
is
way. That's a hard truth from what, a dad to say this. Anyway, keep going.
if I have a problem, I say, here's how I'm feeling. When I saw X, and why this is why I feel this way, right? Or if she does something, "I don't like it when you do that," or "I don't, so I'm very much so direct, and I explain myself, but also She's an active listener. And so I'm and I think everything about communication, especially being a writer, and I think about tone and all these different things. I've never yelled at my wife. I don't do any of that stuff. I've never called her out of her name. Because you don't do that to your friends. And my wife is my friend. So I speak to her. I might be frustrated, right? But I don't scream at her. I don't try to belittle her or any of that stuff. I express how I feel in a direct way, in a way that makes sense, and I don't make her responsible for it. I'm just telling her, like, when you do X, Y, and Z, I don't like it. And here's why I don't like it. But not when you do that, you make me feel like I don't do that. So, and we've had these discussions as far as, if someone does something, they didn't make you feel that way, that you, this is how you're responding to it, but that's also your interpretation. Because when I hear that, I don't think that. Actually, I think it's something else. And so I think how you're interpreting it is off. And we'll talk about it some more. Because, like you said, we didn't see the other possibilities around it. We're basing it off of previous experiences, all these different things. You don't know what someone is going through. And so when someone gives you an alternate viewpoint, then you're able to say, like, oh, why didn't I thought there was only one way that someone would react that way, or someone would be in that situation. So just like that example, you thought, or that person would think, there's only one reason these kids will be running around like this, and it's because the father's a terrible father. And it's like, well, obviously there are multiple reasons why it's going on, right? So let's try to figure out. But that takes, it does take a level of patience and compassion to kind of understand that there are multiple perspectives, multiple reasons why something is going on, and not everything is
Be
malicious.
curious. Be curious. I
Right.
wonder what's going on in this dad that he's letting his kids run all over the train instead of being judgmental, right? You can be curious,
Right.
try to figure. I wonder if there is something going on.
Yeah. And listen, he may be a bad dad, but at the same time, you find this out. And you're like, all right, I'll cut you a little bit of slack. I get it. But yes, I do think that if there's anything that I've learned, especially as I've gotten older, I just turned 40 last year, it's that I am far more empathetic about parents and what they're going through, while at the same time, I am very much so about ownership as the parent. Because if, in the same way, if you screwed up your kid, you're actually the thing to help fix them, right? Because in many ways, the reason why they're screwed up is because they don't have any sort of resolution. They may be still wanting this, and they don't think it can happen, and they're trying to act like they can move on, but it's still something that is bothering them. And at the end of the day, they want you. So many cases where I've seen where the kid is disruptive, or the kid is acting in a particular way, and the parent's frustrated, and I'll listen to them. I was like, you do realize the reason your child is acting like that is because they want more of your attention, not less. And they're like, oh. And I break it down to them. And yes, they want more of your attention. That's why they're doing these particular things, right? Or they're, I think sometimes as adults, we think that children are thinking like an adult way, rather than they don't know how to fully express what they're going through. So if they're going through a rebellious phase, it's not they want to be rebellious to necessarily piss you off. It's because they don't know any other way to express whatever is going on. But one thing that's not going to fix it is telling them to F off and scream at them or abandon them. That's not going to fix it. And more often than not, it's because you're not giving them the attention that they need. You're not giving them any sort of direction. They don't feel like anybody cares. Right? So yes, they're acting rebellious because this is the only way they know how to express that rebellion. But if they're happy and healthy, and are being taught things, yes, they don't break into people's cars. Like happy kids don't violate other people. Happy kids don't take stuff from other people. Like these are kids who are growing up who are lacking something that is essential as to their existence.
Agree with you. So I have a question for you, and you don't have to answer if you don't want, but if you want to, if you knew your dad was listening, I know he's passed away now, but if you knew, what would you tell your dad right now? What would you tell your dad? What would you want? Or maybe I can ask it a different way. What would you tell someone who's in a similar situation where they're not checked into their own kids' lives or your dad?
I would say that you are far more important than you think. I think that's the ultimate message. I think sometimes parents minimize their impact, or a parent might minimize another parent's impact on the kid's life. But they're equally important for different reasons, but they're both important. And the job doesn't end when they turn 18, right? Or that feeling of emptiness that they had when they were a kid doesn't just magically get filled. So if you screwed up, just own it and try to apologize. Do not expect anything. Do not expect an acknowledgement, a forgiveness, or anything like that, because forgiveness is for the child, not for you. So if they are gracious enough to say, "I forgive you," it is for them, so they can release whatever they're holding on to. But your motivation is to take ownership. And let me tell you, if you abandon your kids for 20 years, be prepared to take 20 years of rejection from your kids. I think that's a fair trade. So if your kids are putting you through the wringer for 2 decades and they finally give you an opportunity, well, that's what I think that's a fair trade. Like, it is worth it. It is worth it to fight for your kids. And if you didn't do it early in their life, well, be prepared to do it later on.
There you go. How are we going to fix this problem in our civilization and our families? If I'm saying, Adam, what can we do to help dads want to step up? What should we do?
Remember when they were kids? Much, I didn't have a father to show me how to be a dad. So I would often remember what it was like for me when I was a kid. That ultimately dictated how I disciplined my son, how I talked to my son, how I treat my son. I would think about when I was a kid, and did I like that? Like, did I like getting beat? No, I didn't like it. I felt it was unnecessary. So I didn't do that with my son. Or I should say, I popped him when he was very young and I stopped doing that. I didn't like how it felt, and it wasn't something that I wanted to engage in, because when I was a kid, I thought it was unnecessary. I just wanted someone to talk to me, like explain to me what I did wrong, or just at least have some grace to understand, like, kids mess up. So is hitting fixing them? All these different things. But just remember when you were a kid. If you had your dad in your life, how did it feel to have your dad in your life? Must have felt great, right? Hopefully. Or let's say your dad was in your life, but your dad was a piece of shit. Do you want to be that to your kids? Like, there are different lessons that you can learn, whether your parents were good, happy, healthy parents or terrible parents. There are different lessons that you can learn from it, and you can bring it on to your parenting style when it comes to your kids. But I think, when we become adults, we forget what it was like to be a kid, for very important things. And so we just think with our adult brains, and we lose that empathy when it comes to our children in many ways.
Well, I appreciate this. Is there anything else, Adam? This has been a great chat. Appreciate your insight. Is there anything else that you would tell any dad, or just what do you want to leave with here to say, if you're a dad and you're kind of checked in or kind of checked out, maybe you're totally checked in, maybe you're totally checked out. What would you tell the dads who are listening to this podcast right now? If you could tell them one thing that's important, what would you tell them?
Your choices are not just affecting you. Your choices, whether you decide to stay or whether you decide to leave, whether you decide to get married or you decide to divorce, whatever you decide to do, when you have children involved, it's not just your choice. And this also goes down to who you decide to marry, who you decide to procreate with. These are things that are part of your decision making, right? It's part of family planning. In many cases, we are okay with adults being whimsical. You know, they just slept together and someone ended up pregnant and they just figure out things as they go along. And then we're confused as to why this parenting situation is terrible. And it's because, well, no one planned any of this. No one looked at that person and said, would they be a good mother or father to my kids? They just said, I think they're cute. Let's screw. And so this is why family planning comes in. So when I see people who are like, my baby mom is this way, or my son's father this way, or they're pieces of crap, I was like, well, you picked them. Like, this is ultimately partly your responsibility too. You picked
And
this
again,
person.
no, keep
Yeah.
going.
No, I was gonna say, you picked this person. You're partly responsible for this outcome. You made the choice to have unprotected sex with this person. And as adults, we know what happens when you have unprotected sex. This is the risk. And so this is the way you decided to use your body and to use your body with whom. So if you think they're a piece of shit, well, then you decide to sleep with a piece of shit. Like, this is.
And again, you made your decision based on the feeling at the moment without really going back and saying, what's the principle? How do I have a good family? Well, I probably need to find someone who's got integrity, who's going to do the right thing, even when it's not easy. I need to find someone who's grounded in the golden rule, or as you say, so pro-social behavior. You know what I'm saying? I need to find someone who's grounded in doing the right thing for the right reason. And maybe integrity, and maybe someone who's good in their heart is more important than whether they're cute or not, right? Because that situation that they got themselves into might have been fun for an hour or two or something, but the results for 20 years or 30 years or really for generations is so much not worth whatever fun they had in the moment. Like we need to be able to say, I'm gonna go against my feelings at the moment to do the right thing based on principle. That's what I've been trying to say. I'm gonna choose a good spouse, even though I'm attracted to somebody else who may not be a good spouse. I'm gonna choose to be loyal to that spouse, even though at some point I might have temptation. I'm gonna choose to be kind, even though at some point I'm gonna feel like being not kind. I'm gonna choose to be honest, even though I'm tempted to be dishonest. Those kind of things where we make our decisions based on what's right, not what we feel at the moment, is a huge sign of being a good parent, a good dad, and it's principle based, not feeling based, right?
Amen.
Anyway, hey, how can people get a hold of you, Adam? Where can they find your book, The Children We Left Behind, and how can they get a hold of you?
Yeah, they can purchase the book just about anywhere the books are sold. The audio book should be on most platforms. Depending when this comes out, it should be on Audible. That's the last man standing. But it's on other audiobook platforms. They can also find me at on my Substack, adambcoleman.substack.com. I'm also active on Twitter at wrong underscore speak. And I do have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/@wrong_speak.
Okay. And we'll put all of these in the show notes so that people can get a hold of you. Adam, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and having this conversation. Please get Adam's book. I actually got a copy on Kindle and have read a good portion of it. It's a great book, very moving book. Be prepared to have your heartstrings tugged when you read it. But really appreciate you, Adam, being on the show today. And
Thank you.
we'll put those ways to get a hold of you in the show notes.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.